process in gravity, which is, we call them gravitational instantons, but it describes tunneling. So we've, throughout the course, discussed various quantum mechanical, quantum field theoretic aspects of gravity, but within the context of a classical background and a quantum field theory on the classical background. So this is an example where the background itself, so gravity or geometry, is taking part in an inherently quantum process, i.e. tunneling. And so in some sense, it's at the other end. We can't really do perturbative gravity very easily, but strangely enough, we can talk about non-perturbative processes. So the notion of an instanton, it will see sort of why it's called that once they start describing the process. But the idea is that it's some solution which is centered at an instant, or an instant in some sense in time, although what we'll see is it's Euclidean time. So let's just recall a couple of facts. Now, hang on. Do Canadians spell tunneling with one L or two Ls? I don't know. I know there's a split across the Atlantic, and I just don't know which is which. I'm sometimes rather mixed up about my US-UK English. So I may use both. Any ideas? Does that look right? Yeah, okay, that's the US version. Okay. So the first time we meet tunneling is in the context of a very simple context of quantum mechanics, and we imagine that we've got some incident wave, and then using our Schrödinger equation, we see that even if we have a barrier, so it comes in with incident energy E, whereas our barrier height is V naught, classically, a particle would just get kicked back, but quantum mechanically, a little bit of the wave function can get through the barrier, and so we have a finite probability on the other side of transmission. So here, D is the width of the barrier, and this omega parameter is the frequency, if you like, of the exponential, or the half-life of the exponential decay of the wave function as through this barrier. So omega D is given by an integral of the potential. It's really the sort of total height of this barrier. So it's the volume, if you like, of the potential that your wave function has to tunnel through. And so we could compare this just in terms of thinking about evaluating that integral to a particle, classical particle, so if we kind of imagine just softening the edges of our potential well, then our particle, we could imagine, has a trajectory whereby it rolls, if its energy is precisely on this level, it rolls down, moves across, creeps up here, and bounces back again. So in this case, we would have a half x dot squared being delta v. Call it tau rather than t. So we have this sort of notion that this integral that we see over here has the same value as a classical particle moving in the inverted potential well. So that's really just to motivate the technique that we're going to use to compute tunneling amplitudes. So essentially what we're doing here, if you notice that the wave function out here is oscillatory, in here it's exponential, and out here again it's oscillatory. If you were to analytically continue to an imaginary parameter here, then that would look like, again, a real wave function. So the idea is that what you're doing when you compute a tunneling process is you're analytically continuing to Euclidean time and then doing a classical motion. So it's coming from a sort of WKB type approximation to the wave function and looking at it in this region here. And you see that that is, in fact, the dynamics, or what you're trying to solve is a Euclidean set of equations of motion. So that's the technique for calculating tunneling amplitudes in a situation where you may not have some nice clean form for your potential. So the action, or your tunneling amplitude, so for the particle, things are relatively simple. You can sort of calculate a tunneling amplitude directly, but once you go to a situation in field theory, the easiest way of doing it is looking at the Euclidean equations of motion, calculating this bounce, so a process by which you look at a Euclidean solution which interpolates between one side of the barrier and the other side of the barrier. You find that classical solution, you compute its Euclidean action, and that is the equivalent of this tunneling amplitude, this bounce action. So you've got here would be a generic sort of focusing in, some generic potential where you've got a metastable state. And so your bounce, see if I can invert it. Okay. So So your bounce solution would be where you would roll down. Up to the point of emergence and back again. So that's the picture of what's going on. So let's look at it in the context of the false vacuum. So this is referring, I've written down some of these original papers because they're actually rather readable and very nicely written. So it's easiest to see by example. And I'm going to go through the original example that Sidney Coleman looked at. So I'm taking something that we've seen before, a double well potential, and I'm just giving it a slight kick by tilting it. So I'm making one of the minima not an actual vacuum state. So we've got a false vacuum here, roughly at minus eta, a true vacuum roughly at plus eta, and the energy difference between them is going to be relatively small compared to the height of the barrier. Mm-hmm. Yeah, didn't I do that last time? Yeah, I think it must be because I've written all these squares here. I'm sort of twoed out or something. You know? Thanks. So we call minus eta the false vacuum. So the reason for that is it looks like a vacuum, because if you start to quantize around minus eta, you'll get sensible results perturbatively because it's a local minimum of the potential. However, it's not the true vacuum because we know from standing back and looking at the potential that somewhere else there's a minimum which has a lower energy. So that's why we call it a false vacuum. It's false because it's not really the lowest energy state, but it's still meaningful. It's not an unstable location. You can still have, it's still a local minimum. So here, V is roughly epsilon. And at phi equals plus eta, this is the true vacuum. Where V is roughly zero. Oh, actually, it's exactly zero, but the true vacuum's perturbed slightly from eta. So if we imagine ourselves to be in the false vacuum, then we would imagine classically, although we would stay in the false vacuum, we would imagine quantum mechanically our wave function would know something about this other vacuum over here. And so we might imagine that there is a possibility of suddenly nucleating a region of true vacuum. And we call this a sort of instance of metastability in the sense of we're stable to small perturbations, but we could imagine either a tunneling process or some sort of wild thermal fluctuation might sort of kick us over this barrier and into the true vacuum. minute, I'm just checking I've got the right signs here. Okay, so if I'm looking for a Euclidean time solution, that means I analytically continue t goes to I tau. So my Lorentzian time goes to Euclidean time, so we've seen that before. And then I ask, is there a solution to my Euclidean equations of motion? Now, asymptotically, this idea of the bounds means I've got to imagine that my background state is going to be false vacuum, but what I'm looking for or thinking about is having some true vacuum somewhere in the middle of the false vacuum. So here, as we go across our Euclidean space, so note it's flat space, of course, we're going from false vacuum to true vacuum and back again. So that's our bounce. So looking for a solution, we expect spherical symmetry. That's a sort of, seems like it would be the lowest energy configuration. So if I look at that equation of motion, if I look at the setup has a very small energy difference between the two vacua relative to the size of the barrier. So I might expect that what happens is that phi is very roughly constant inside and pretty constant outside, and just goes through that potential barrier rather rapidly in some region. So this is, you've seen this before, a thin wall type of picture. And then we can see whether it is consistent, yeah?
What are the primes in there?
Rho. And rho is the spherical radius out in four-dimensional Euclidean space.
So I assume that you make like some separation of variables.
There. Yeah.
But then the right-hand side, if I say that phi is just a function of r and times function of theta and phi, if you want spherical symmetry, shouldn't the right-hand side change because of the phi squared minus theta squared?
But in what way? So I mean, all I've said, no, I'm not. I'm looking for a purely spherically symmetric solution that depends only on the distance from the Euclidean origin. So it's a function of one. I've gone from a four-dimensional PDE down to a one-dimensional ODE by imagining or saying that typically when you think about bubble nucleation, a bubble when it nucleates is round, essentially, because that's kind of minimizing a surface area relative to internal volume. So at the moment, you know, I'm sort of saying, well, this is kind of, you know, it seems a physically reasonable thing to do. And actually, when we start putting in gravity, we'll have slightly stronger reasons for doing that, simply because gravity, you know, if you actually look at the equations of motion of this thin wall, they want to have a trace of extrinsic curvature vanishing, typically, or there's an equation of motion. So again, there are stronger reasons for looking for this type of solution. At the moment, I'm just saying it seems sensible you know, it looks like it's going to minimize the action. So I'm now going to suppose that, just again, at the moment, I'm just walking through trying to get an answer that seems plausible using some ideas. We can then ask ourselves whether it was sensible to make those assumptions. So the plausibility is saying that, well, if this barrier is fairly high relative to the energy differential, then I would expect that the only way I'm going to get a sensible tunneling process is if I have a sufficiently large bubble. So you're thinking somehow of there being competition between the energy that you gain from tunneling from false to true vacuum and the energy that it costs you by producing the wall. So there's a competition between those two factors. And so if the energy, you know, if that energy differential is fairly small, you would expect you've got to create at least a reasonable size bubble. And once you get to a reasonable size bubble, then I'm going to say, let's just ignore this term here and say to leading order, I'm solving this ODE, which we've seen in the context of the domain wall. Now, I'm only using this as a plausibility argument so I can present an analytic solution, okay? You can take these Euclidean equations of motion for any sort of similarly looking potential, doesn't even have to have such a small differential, and you can just pop it on the computer and integrate it out, and you'll find a solution for phi, and then you'll find a solution for the action. But the beauty of this argument is that it's something which is approximate, but it's analytical. So you can write it down and present it without sort of telling people, okay, sort of hit enter and integrate. And of course, it was what Sidney Coleman did in that original paper. So this is an approximate solution, and it's saying that our profile of the phi field, well, it's a tanh, and so as long as we're not within the width, 1 over root lambda eta of the core, that's essentially constant. It's going to either be minus eta or plus eta, and then all the action happens in a small region around rho naught. So this captures the essentials of the solution. So now, if I ask what the action of my bounce is, well, it's going to be, in this context, it's going to be the action of the wall. And then I've got to subtract off the energy that was inside the bubble. Let us say action. So if I look at the action of the wall, then this part So this part originally, that would have been the analytically continued Euclidean action, but I know that this is just phi prime squared, where prime is now d by d rho, and so what I get is the integral of 2v d rho but then I know that if I integrate across the wall, my energy density, which is what this is, I just get the tension of the wall. So I'm denoting that by sigma, tension or energy per unit area. Meanwhile, the inside that's no longer at the false vacuum, just as a volume term times the energy difference epsilon. So that tells me that I can represent my bounce action as a difference of two terms involving this rho naught, which at the moment I haven't given you any indicator what that actually is. So let me now say that if it's a solution to the equations of motion, then it's going to be stationary. It's going to be a stationary point of the action. And therefore, if this rho naught that I've written down is a parameter of my solution, then it should be stationary with respect to variation, with respect to variation by rho naught. So let me look at what that means. If I differentiate with respect to rho naught, then I get a relation between sigma and epsilon. Hang on, I think I'm missing a rho naught here. Between sigma, epsilon, and rho naught. So I input that back in my action. So I've got to put in rho naught is 3 sigma on epsilon. So I get overall here, I've got a 27 from 3 sigma cubed, 27 sigma to the fourth. And then the rest is divided by factors of epsilon cubed. So this is my bounce action. So you can see that I said initially for my potential that the discrepancy between the vacua, the difference between the false vacuum and true vacuum energy, was small relative to the height of the bounce. And the height of the bounce is given by sigma. And so that's telling me that this rho naught that I get here is going to be bigger than 1. So I've gone back and checked that the assumption that I made in doing this analytic approximation is valid. I said that the bubble should be big in order to say that everything happens near rho naught. I put that in, I calculate a rho naught, and I see that it is in fact big. Another way of seeing that it could be big was thinking about the competition between the energy gain by tunneling down to the vacuum and the energy cost in the wall. So you can kind of see it from, you know, both sides. So let's now think about what we've constructed. What we've constructed is this bubble here in Euclidean space, which sits at some fixed rho naught. So our solution goes from being true vacuum inside through a wall to false vacuum. So let me now analytically continue back. So my rho squared was tau squared plus x squared, and that was rho naught squared at the wall. And that goes to minus t squared plus x squared is rho naught squared. So we're back to one of these hyperboloids. And so what we have in Lorentzian flat space time is we've got true vacuum inside a hyperboloid. We've got false vacuum outside the hyperboloid, and we have a domain wall. So that's what our solution looks like in a Lorentzian sense. So what's the tunneling process? Well, the tunneling process, we would say that to the past, we have false vacuum, and then suddenly, at say t equals naught, a bubble of true vacuum appears and then it expands outwards. So we could imagine thinking about the tunneling process of analytically continuing from Lorentzian real time to Euclidean imaginary time. And we have our bubble, which is now spherical, and we'd like to somehow just glue those two pictures together. And so we have this sort of image of our tunneling process as being a Euclidean bubble. So this is kind of a virtual bubble forming, but then at t equals zero, we suddenly have in real space a bubble of true vacuum, which then expands. And so to kind of match these two solutions on, you've got to match them at a surface where there's no time derivative, because otherwise you have trouble identifying real and imaginary time derivatives. So this is the sort of standard picture of this tunneling from the false vacuum. And so what you might expect then from this flat space perspective is you would say, well, okay, I have a bubble, I've got some probability of it forming, which I know because I've calculated my bounce action. And so eventually I get rid of my false vacuum and I've tunneled everywhere into true vacuum. But of course, we've been doing a course on gravitational physics, so we say, hang on, let's see if that's really a consistent picture. We've seen this before. We calculated our gravitational field of a domain wall, which wasn't so much a gravitational field, but more a case of sort of needlework or stitchery in terms of gluing together pieces of different geometries. And the domain wall, although it looked like this, in reality, although the inside was flat space with a hyperboloid, the outside was actually also the interior of a hyperboloid. So it was a copy of the interior. So it's not really exactly the same setup. Moreover, if we're sitting in false vacuum, let's actually ask, what does that mean? So that would be phi equals minus eta, and v equals epsilon. Well, our energy momentum tensor phi doesn't have any gradient, so the energy momentum tensor is just proportional to the metric. So we've seen that as well. This tells us that our false vacuum is in no way flat Minkowski spacetime. Our false vacuum has to be a de Sitter spacetime. And so the length scale of our de Sitter space is 3 over lambda. Which is 3 over 8 pi g epsilon. So our constant energy is epsilon, so our cosmological constant is 8 pi g epsilon. So if epsilon is small, our length scale of our de Sitter space is big, so we're nearly flat, but the geometry isn't exactly flat. So we have to think about taking that into account if we want to do this fully consistently. So if we were just interested in some sort of localized laboratory experiment where we were looking at some order parameter that was or something that was taking us from false vacuum to true vacuum, we'd be perfectly fine to do this Minkowski type of tunneling calculation. However, and the reason for the following papers by including De Lucia, in the late 70s, Coleman wanted to apply this to a situation in the universe. So people were starting to think about the implications of quantum field theory in the early universe. And so if you had a scalar field in a false vacuum that was metastable, how might it decay? If you're thinking about the universe as a whole, you cannot afford to ignore gravity. So that's what we're now going to do. We're going to sit and actually include gravity into the process. So gravitationally, so the picture now is going to be, if I sketch the same story for Euclidean and Lorentzian, because this length scale of de Sitter is quite large, we might expect that at least pictorially I've got something similar to what I just put down for the field theory. But inside here, I need to have Minkowski spacetime, because that's my true vacuum. Outside, I need to have de Sitter space-time, because that's my false vacuum. And then between the two, I have my wall, and so these are the solutions that I have to construct. So we know how to do this. We use Gauss-Kadatze. So inside, I've got flat space-time. I'm looking at the Euclidean case here. So my flat space-time is just R4 in spherical coordinates. So it was what we had over here. So our wall is at rho naught, our normal, and this will be an outward normal, is going to be d by d rho. That points outwards. So our k, I'm going to use the Israel equations here, so our k on the inside . So I evaluate my extrinsic curvature on the surface, rho equals rho naught. So the derivative of that normal, it's just got a unit length, is simply going to be the connection components, and they're just the derivative of g alpha beta, which are these angular coordinates. So I just pick up this factor of 1 on rho naught. So outside, I've got Euclidean de Sitter space. So that is a four sphere of radius L, and so I write down the metric for a unit four sphere and simply multiply by L. And here, of course, we have to remember that our L is 3 over 8 pi g epsilon. I've got that up there. So our wall is going to be at chi naught. And here we need an inward normal. So our normal is now 1 over L, d by d chi. So in both cases, it's kind of pointing to larger chi. And our k plus is also represented in terms of g alpha beta. So if I patch these together, these two solutions, if I'm patching two sides of a geometry together, the intrinsic metrics or induced metrics have to be the same on each side. So that tells me this rho here, rho squared, has to be the same as this pre-multiplying factor over here. So it tells me that rho naught equals L sine chi naught. So that allows me to identify quantities in K minus with quantities in K plus. And then my Israel conditions tell me that cot chi naught on L minus K minus, which is 1 over rho naught, so that's cosec chi naught on L. So that's my differential of K. And then that's got to equal minus 4 pi g sigma. So I get a relation between the between the tension of my wall, the curvature of my de Sitter space, and the place at which I'm identifying the two pieces of space-time. So now I need to calculate the action of this Euclidean solution. M plus. So I put together all my different pieces. So at the moment, I've got in principle an inside, an outside, a boundary and the energy momentum of the wall. So here I'm distinguishing, I'm not including any potential delta function in R. I'm simply splitting my space-time into two pieces, and if I do that, I've got to add the boundary terms. And so this is my full action, but of course what I've got to do is I've got to subtract off what was there originally. And so what I'm left with is a very similar sort of pattern to what I calculated in the field theory. I'm left with the interior. So that gives me some integration of the piece of de Sitter space that I've lost. And then I've got to integrate across the wall. The difference, the jump in the extrinsic curvature and the wall tension. Okay, so for my de Sitter space, R is minus 4 lambda, so the first piece gives me 2 lambda, but of course I know that lambda is 8 pi g epsilon. So that tells me that I've got epsilon. And then the volume integral. So I've got to take 2 pi squared L to the fourth integral from naught to chi naught sine cubed chi d chi. So that's the volume of de Sitter space that I've lost times the corresponding energy. Then if I use my Israel equations, delta K is minus 12 pi g sigma. So I end up with minus sigma on 2 times an area integral of the wall. And so that would be 2 pi squared rho naught cubed. So those are the two pieces that I get for my action. So now I'm going to replace for epsilon, because my epsilon is given somewhere as in terms of L. So here, I've replaced in the first part, I've done my integral of sine cubed. So that's the thing in square brackets. That gives me a third cos cubed minus cos. And then I've replaced my epsilon as being 3 over 8 pi gl squared. So that gives me this factor here. And then for the second piece, I've replaced rho naught. So rho naught is L sine chi naught. So that's that piece here. And then I'm replacing sigma using the Israel conditions. So that's where this piece comes from. And so putting it all together, you can see that I've got now this sign is going to cancel with that one. And if I put everything into a single bracket and simplify, I find it reduces to a fairly nice expression. So you can go and check that. And then I can, if I want, re-express that. In terms of my tension parameter. So this is the Coleman-De Lucia, usually CDL, result. And it's the action of a gravitational instanton, which takes us from De Sitter space to Minkowski space. So some ways you sometimes see of it being drawn. This De Sitter space is an S4. And so this would be the angle chi, and this would be chi naught. And you've take your sphere and literally just chop it. And that is your flat geometry is where you've chopped off. So this is the picture of the instanton. And then if I analytically continue back to real time, this is going to be a challenge for me because artistic I'm not, I get a hyperboloid where, again, I've kind of chopped off my whatever. I've chopped off my hyperboloid, so my De Sitter space is like a hyperboloid in Lorentzian space-time, and I simply truncate that at some point, and this is my true vacuum, or Minkowski space. So that is the interpretation, or the standard interpretation, of the Coleman De Lucia instanton. And so when Alan Guth originally tried to construct a theory of inflation, whereby he tried to solve some of the problems that were existing in standard cosmology by supposing that there was a period of early rapid expansion of the universe, he used this sort of picture. The early rapid expansion was driven by a cosmological constant, and the cosmological constant was produced by a false vacuum. And then he supposed that somehow this decay of the false vacuum would exit you from inflation. So you'll probably be hearing about this in the cosmology course. The problem was that this action, either you had too low a probability of tunneling, and so you never exited. You see, the difference between the picture here of the pure field theory is that space is fixed. So when the bubble expands, it's eating up more and more of the false vacuum. Trouble with the gravitational picture is De Sitter space is also expanding. And so the bubble never eats up the whole of De Sitter space. And so that, if you like, was the source of the problem with trying to use metastability in and tunneling, originally in inflation. Now, just in 2 minutes, with no explicit formulae, I wanted to just tell you a little bit about a recent paper that I wrote with Ian Moss and Ben Withers. Because you should be able to get conceptually what's going on. So we took Coleman de Lucia, this picture, but instead of having pure De Sitter space, we put Schwarzschild De Sitter outside and then looked at tunneling either to Minkowski or a Schwarzschild solution with potentially a different mass. So you've seen how we construct those wall solutions. And so you can imagine, at least structurally, how you go about calculating this Euclidean solution. You have to do the Israel junction conditions again. That's going to give you a different relation. It's no longer going to give you just something that's nice and analytic, because with Schwarzschild de Sitter, you have to work in static coordinates. So Schwarzschild de Sitter, if you remember, it was 1 minus 2gm on R minus R squared on L squared. Schwarzschild de Sitter has two horizons. So you've got a horizon at 2gm roughly, and a horizon roughly at L. So the Coleman de Lucia instanton has no 2gm, and so you basically fix your Euclidean section to have a given periodicity of Euclidean time. Here, with Schwarzschild de Sitter, you've got a beta standard periodicity of Euclidean time at one horizon, a standard periodicity of Euclidean time at another, your cosmological horizon, they're not the same. And then your wall solution typically has some sort of oscillatory type of form, and that has a third, potentially a different periodicity. So you can construct these instantons, so you can construct the solutions, and people had actually looked at this back in the 80s. The problem was that they hadn't taken into account, they hadn't done the computation of the action properly, because these instantons are necessarily singular. They have conical singularities. And so people had not computed the effect of those singularities properly. So taking into account the effect of, or the contribution to the bounce action of conical singularities, we showed that the instantons did not depend on the choice of periodicity of Euclidean time, which meant you could fix it to give you a proper nice wall solution. And then when you go and recompute the Kolmogorov-De Lucia type of bounce action, you find that the bounce action drops. So with a black hole, so that tells you that tunneling is more likely. Moreover, not only is tunneling more likely, but the bubble is centered on the black hole. And so you have this picture of gravitational inhomogeneities, or, I mean, they could be a black hole, it could just be some very dense concentration of matter, actually acts to precipitate vacuum decay. So it's one of these instances where you can compute tunneling in a very exact way, where you have complete homogeneity and isotropy of your field configuration, and you get one answer. But of course, in practice, when you think about a first-order phase transition, usually it's impurities that act as nucleation sites for the true vacuum. And so what we're seeing is, in spite of the fact gravity is so very different from sort of normal scale physics or small scale physics, the actual process of this tunneling and this vacuum decay seems to have, you know, quite a nice correspondence with our own physical intuition of phase transitions and of these processes. So that's given you, it's rather a nice piece of Kolman. I mean, I do recommend you look at those original papers. So this work of Kolmogorov-De Lucia is a nice and important piece of gravitational physics. People use the Kolmogorov-De Lucia result all the time when they're looking at, you know, stability of metastable states, and just to sort of try and indicate that, you know, the things that you've been learning in this course really are tools that you can use, in gravitational physics research. So, end of course.